Welcome back to the Discovering Forestry podcast. My name is Corey. I'm one of your hosts alongside our friend, industry expert, Mr. Joe Aitken, here for another compelling conversation about trees. Joe, I'm sitting here. The snow is falling. The temperatures are dropping. It's a beautiful thing. I love winter. I love it. How are you? How's winter back in Michigan?
Yeah, I'm still a winter guy. I still like hockey, skating. I love snowmobiling, being out in the winter. But we've had a really dry and not too cold of a winter. And I'm kind of curious, you know, and I'm glad you brought that up, is that how is that going to affect spring? So maybe it's what we talk about today. They said, we're squeezing in between all the trade shows, and there's a lot of great presentations being out there, and there's a lot being discussed about environmental conditions. And then when you bring up like that, Corey, because you're up in the mountains and you got a good snowpack, and you guys are going to have some moisture. It's not a big drought. But how does that affect certain regions around the country?
Well, and what are the different perspectives on it? Because as you and a number of our listeners know, we were closest to a 100,000 acre wildfire. So as much as we do want moisture, I was at a conference earlier this month or last month, and they were talking about, well, we don't want that much moisture to where we have landslides and to where the runoff is uncontrollable. So it, you know, to hear different perspectives on it is also a good thing.
Here's a good tidbit. So I was in Canada, and we're talking about how good the plants did and how much fruit was on it, how flowerful. Mm. And because of your wildfire, I guess a lot of those particulates get into the airstream and they precipitate out. And you think about all that, it's like Mother Nature's way to spread biochar.
Whoa.
Let's jot that one down for a discussion one day. But I think when we get into this situation, when we talk about environmental changes, drought, no drought, it makes perfect sense to invite our guest, one of your and I's good friends, colleagues, a lot of respect for his wisdom in the industry. And I think it'd be great to get his perspective on a totally different part of the country, in what his experience will do to help us elsewhere. What do you think?
I think that's awesome. So our guest today is none other than Emmett Minnick out of our Dallas-Fort Worth area in Texas. So Emmett, welcome to the podcast. How are you?
Thanks for having me on, guys. I'm doing great. And I enjoy the conversation. You talking about snowfall and winter. And here in Texas, I'm in North Texas, and we're looking at spring already, guys. I've got maples are flowering. I've seen some willows and oaks they're starting to green up on the tips, which is something I always see in the spring. So we're moving right along. Winter is done, and I'm the opposite of you guys. You can have that white stuff. I don't want it. We get about a week of it annually, and I don't want any more of that.
Didn't you get hit with some white stuff a few years back this late in the year, though? That a couple of years ago? Right around this time, you got
2021, we got drilled. Winter Storm Uri came through with a bunch of snow and ice, and it shut down the Texas power grid. And yeah, that was a bad deal. And it's not uncommon to get weather here in early February, but it seemed we got our weather about mid-January this year. And now things are warming up, and I enjoy it, man. Saw some crane flies out yesterday, and they're the first insects to come out in the spring.
Wow. Already. I would knock on some wood, though. I would just be careful because Mother Nature's, she's tricky sometimes. You might get another snowstorm, Emmett.
It could happen. It could happen.
So, Emmett, let's bring our listeners up to date. Can you tell us a little bit about your education and your journey and how you got to where you are today?
Ah, Okay, so my education, so I've got to back up further than that. I grew up in a rural area of Texas. I grew up near Hondo, Texas, which is west of San Antonio. So grew up on my family's farm and ranch, and worked out there through my childhood. And when it came time to go to school, I had absolutely no idea what I was going to do. And my grandpa had told me my entire life to don't ever be a farmer. And it's actually funny because it kind of plays into our conversation today. And one of his main reasons was because you're gambling with the weather every season, you know, especially in Texas where irrigation is so important. And if you can't irrigate your crop, you're going to have a bad year. And so, you know, my grandpa, he told me, don't ever be a farmer, don't ever be a farmer. And so I didn't know what I was going to do when I went to college. And my mom said, oh, you know, I could see you being a pharmacist. Why don't you go into pharmacy? I said, sure, mom. So that's what I majored in when I went to school at Texas Tech, was pre-pharmacy. And I did that for 3 semesters. My grades were terrible. I learned, like, all I was taking was your basics, science, history, math, political science, English, stuff like that. It was boring. And I didn't take a single course related to pharmaceuticals. And my grades were terrible. So I decided to change majors. And I had grown up in the 4-H program and FFA and things like that. And so I was involved with the county extension agent in my hometown. And so I was like, you know what? That county extension agent, that's kind of a cool job. I could see myself doing that, get, you know, be involved with the youth and agriculture and things like that. And so I changed my major to agronomy. And as soon as I changed my major, my grades improved drastically because I was learning about things that I actually enjoyed learning about. And so then, you know, I continued that. And then I found out that a county extension agent, well, they are required to get a master's degree in order to hold that position. And I said, well, that's not for me. I'm not going to continue my education past my undergrad. But then I met a girl. And so I'm a couple of years older than my wife. And so she was behind me in school. And so I'm coming on graduating. I'm like, well, yeah, I'm not going to leave this girl behind. And so I got the opportunity to continue my education on at Texas Tech and ended up getting a master's degree in crop science. And my grandpa told me, don't ever be a farmer. So I got a bachelor's in agronomy and a master's in crop science. And, you know, all things were kind of trending for me to move into the row crop sector of agriculture. And I have some good friends that are in that industry. I mean, it's huge. Agriculture is such a huge industry. But because I met that girl from Dallas, that's where she wanted to move after we graduated. And so I said, well, they're not growing cotton in Dallas, and so I've got to find something else to do. And that's when I started looking at parallel industries, you know, what else can I do with this education that I've gotten? And so I found a job opening for a plant healthcare technician for a local tree care company. And I was kind of reading about plant healthcare and Google searching. And I was like, oh, you know what? That sounds really cool. This is something that I could see myself doing. And so I took 0 courses in horticulture or woody plants or arboriculture, 0. All of my education was on soils, plant physiology, crop physiology. One of my favorite courses was modes and mechanisms of herbicide action. And so that's what I studied. And so I found this opportunity with the plant healthcare tech, and I pursued that. I actually interviewed with several tree care companies in the Dallas area because I thought that was going to be a good fit for me. It ended up going back to the original one, which is kind of a mom and pop small business, and started out as a plant healthcare tech. And I knew 0 things about trees. I was like crash course studying myself. Like the guy had a blog of like all of his favorite or like local trees for Dallas. And I made my own plant or tree identification book prior to starting there. And I was trying to bone up on my tree ID because this is something I'd never done. And so that's how I got into the industry. And I worked in that position, plant health technician for like a year or two, and then was the plant healthcare manager, and kind of they were directing me into like a sales arborist role, which was not really what I wanted to do. I really enjoyed the plant healthcare side and the products and chemistries and the science that's all involved in that. And so I began searching for other opportunities deeper into plant healthcare. And that's actually how I found the position with ArborJet, as I was looking to add the ArborJet product line to our arsenal at that company and found they were looking for a rep in Texas. And so that's how I got connected with ArborJet and been in this role for about 10 years.
And it's hard, 10 years.
Yeah.
It flew by, Emmett. It really has. And I remember when you came on board and it was exciting. But you bring a lot more than just arboriculture to ArborJet. And I think that's what made you so unique, is that it's not just, it's your background, it's your education. And it's almost as though arboriculture was secondary, but it's all the primary education that you got made you so valuable. Because you're right, a tree's a crop. I don't care how you look at it, where you put it. It's still a crop, still a plant, and still growing. But I'm glad you're here, buddy.
Well, thanks. It's funny you say that, Joe, because when I was a young technician and like I was going out on properties and you have Miss Betty Crocker asking you about, hey, what's wrong with this plant or what's this? And I'm so green. Like I had no clue. And, you know, I'm bringing in branches from the field. Like I'd cut whole limbs out of trees that had weird symptoms. And I'm bringing that stuff back on my truck to show to the owner of the company. And one day, Joe, what you just said kind of clicked in my head. I was like, you know what? Trees are just big plants. And I understand plants. And from like, I remember that happening and I was like, I can do this. But I think a lot of people in the plant healthcare world have that stumbling block of people are scared of trees, especially diagnosing and sick trees. They're like, whoa.
Yeah, malpractice, mess up.
So I don't know that answer.
I think as simple as a tree is, it is a very complex organism. And I think a lot of times by the time it gets to Corey, yourself, Emmett, or myself, it's at a point where everybody else has looked at it and can't figure it out. So you're like, oh boy, what do you do now? So you got to go back to some really, you got to go way back to figure out what's going on with this tree. And I'm kind of hoping that maybe we could discuss some of that today. That again, we get pictures all the time. Hey, what's wrong with my tree? And half the pictures are horrible because they're standing 100 yards away. Can you tell what's wrong with this tree? I says, is it really a tree? It looks like a shrub. But understanding that there is a process. I know when I started my career, there's a book out there, How Trees Die, and someone laughed at me because I spent most of my early time in arboriculture learning how trees die, because if you know how a tree dies, you know how a tree lives. And there's certain processes within that that's required for a tree to survive. And when any one of those are compromised, the tree starts to decline, makes it susceptible to other pathogens. And I think in today's day and age, a lot of it does not even have to do with soil or anything. It has to do with what we talked about at the beginning of the podcast. It's hard to measure, but it's environmental stresses.
Right. And I think that's something that I've tried to help people overcome. Because you're right, I get pictures sent to me all the time. What's wrong with this? What do I do here? And the trap that I see people falling into is jumping to conclusions, especially when it comes to abiotic versus biotic issues of trees. Everybody wants to blame a pathogen for something. They see scorching on a leaf. Oh, it's bacterial leaf scorch because it's in the name. And I say, hey, wait, it's August. It hasn't rained in 6 weeks and it's 105 degrees outside. It might just be abiotic leaf scorch going on there. And so that's really what I want to get into today, guys, is talking about drought management and strategies, especially for recovering drought stress trees, because last year in Texas, we had, and really through a lot of the Midwestern states, we had a very intense summer. It's what they would call a flash drought. I don't know, in my area, DFW, it stopped raining about the middle of June, and we didn't get significant rainfall again until about the middle of September. So we went 3 months in some very intense summer. August last year was one of the most intense Augusts we've ever had on record. And it was pretty debilitating to a lot of the landscape plants out there.
Emmett, let's definitely elaborate on that tonight or today, but let's also talk about heat. You know, when people are thinking Texas, they're thinking heat. So you have this combination of heat and dry. And I remember talking to you last summer and you were saying, hey, Corey, it's still triple digits at night. And my jaw is still on the ground. It's triple digits at night and it hasn't rained in months.
Yeah.
I mean, what's all this doing to the trees? What does this mean?
Yeah. So especially in the city, I mean, DFW is massive, and people that aren't from here or haven't visited here, they just don't understand the size of this metro area in Texas. And so with the metro area, you get all of that heat releasing out of the asphalt and out of the concrete in the evenings. And so it wasn't quite triple digits at night, Corey, but it was in the 90s still. And it's just oppressive heat. It's some of that stuff where you walk out in the morning, it's just like, it's not going to be a good day today. And, you know, it's normal to get hot here, triple 100 to 103. That's pretty normal. But this past August, we were getting up to, I think there were some days that got up to like 108, which is more of what you'd see in like the Phoenix area, which that type of heat, it just hits different. And so it's very debilitating. And so, Joe, you mentioned studied a book, How Trees Die. And that's really what I've been talking to people about lately. And it goes back to Mannion's disease spiral, which I know you guys are familiar with that. And it wasn't until I started teaching my, you know, CEU type courses and putting that up there on the screen and explaining to people what this spiral means that it kind of clicked in my head again. It's like, oh, now I really get this, you know? And so how a tree dies is it's predisposed. That's step one. And there's a predisposing factor. It's like, okay, well, what is that? And I would say most trees living in an urban environment are a bit predisposed in some way, shape, or form.
Wrong tree, wrong spot. So we could use, that's one of the basics of planting.
You know, through Dallas, which is a city of planted trees. So if I go down into old Dallas, all the trees are about 120 years old because that's when that area was developed. And there's also a lot of money down there. And so those people tend to water their yards a lot. And so maybe the predisposition of those trees is that they're over-irrigated and maybe they have some type of Phytophthora root rot infection, low grade, or maybe a more moderate grade to where it's beyond a predisposing factor. And then you move up, you know, to where things are newly developed and you have these little baby trees. But what I see with the construction nowadays is they're scraping the topsoil, and a lot of these trees are being planted in the sub horizons where the soil is not meant for plant life. And so that's your other factor, right? And so you have this variation, maybe predisposed because of the irrigation, maybe it's predisposed because of poor soil, maybe it's predisposed just from lack of care, right? And so there's all these things that can predispose a tree to stress, and then you enter into that flash drought that I described earlier, and that's your inciting factor. That's what really triggers the decline of the tree. And so the tree's going downhill fast from that. And then the things that finish them off is called the contributing factor, which is your opportunistic insects and diseases. So what I saw this year on trees that I was observing was wood borers going crazy. And I think that wood borers are continue to go crazy in our area over the next couple of years, especially on red oak species. So our Schumard or Schumard hybrids, and then also water oaks, very, very susceptible to different types of wood boring pests. And so I'd expect to see that on those species, especially, but definitely really on anything. wood borers will get on pretty much any tree. So
we have opportunistic pests like wood borers coming to these stressed trees. Is it too late? How do we manage the current situation, and how much worse do you think it's going to get if we continue on this path?
Yeah. So what was really interesting, and I have a series of photos that I've been showing to people. There's a parking lot that is not too far from where I live, and is really interesting. There's two trees and parking lot islands, and I noticed them as early August, and they started to flash. So they started to scorch rapidly. And so I was taking pictures of these trees, and I followed them throughout the month of August. And the company who manages that property, it's like they fixed the irrigation on one, but not the other. And so over the course of like 18 days, the one that they didn't fix the irrigation on, it went down hard. And it reached what's called the ultimate wilting point, which is where that tree is not going to come back. So you have different things. One's called the permanent wilting point. So that's where your leaves, they get crispy. And if you put water back on that tree, those leaves are not going to, they're not going to turn back to green, right? So that's called the permanent wilting point. And then the ultimate wilting point is where you put water back on that tree, it doesn't matter because it's already shut down and it's dying.
Yeah, it's
fire. And so the other one they did fix the irrigation on, and the leaves turned brown and scorched and they fell off, but it re-leafed within a few days. And so that was kind of wow. Cool. But then I also saw wood borers hit both of those trees. I could see small holes like the size of a pencil lead of where these wood borers had hit. And I'm not exactly sure of what species they were. I didn't peel the bark back to look, but some type of wood borer, maybe an ambrosia beetle, or it's very common to get, there's a flat-headed wood borer that get on oaks. It's called the flat-headed apple tree borer. That's pretty common.
It's just amazing that it can happen that fast. You know, I think a lot of our listeners often won't get the call until well after these symptoms appear in the plant.
Right.
Which makes it even harder to manage. You add severe drought conditions, lack of labor, lack of qualified eyes to look at something like that. Man, being a tree has got to be difficult, especially in these ever-changing environments.
Right. And so what I've been trying to teach people about is a management approach. So you look at Mannion's disease spiral, or how a tree dies, and that's how you're going to come up with a plan. And so what I've been proposing is a three-step action plan. So step one, you've got to stop the bleeding. The real problem, we haven't been getting any rainfall. So you've got to fix that irrigation to be optimized for that situation, whatever it is. And generally, I think watering trees with irrigation, even in those peak summer months, if you can get a thorough watering once a week on a tree, it's going to be okay. Now, granted, there may be some more water-loving species that might need more frequent, but if you can get a good soaking once a week on a tree, it's probably going to make it through those peak intervals. So that's step one, optimize the irrigation. Step two is to address those opportunistic insects and diseases. And so talked about wood borers, an opportunistic disease is going to be like a canker disease. So on oaks here, we'll see hypoxylum canker flare up in those situations. Leland cypress is another tree that we see in the landscape, and ceridium canker will flare up in those situations. So you could do things with different disease control products, maybe like a potassium phosphite, to help kind of boost that tree's natural defense system to ward off those canker diseases. So that's step two. And then step three would be managing the soil. So doing things to encourage root development. And another thing I talk about a lot is, so that parking lot island tree, we started to see the tree decline early in August. It had already gone about 6-7 weeks with no rainfall. And it wasn't until the temperatures peaked that it flashed out. But during that whole time, the soil is drying out. And so I'll show some pictures of soil that's completely cracked open that I took in my HOA. And you've got to think, if the soil is getting that dry, what is happening to the tree's root system? Mm.
I'm glad you brought that up because you beat me to asking you the question. Because when we talk about permanent wilting point, and we spent the last 5-10 minutes talking about signs and symptoms of above grade, it still has to go back, and with your knowledge in agronomy and below grade and roots and fine root hairs, you know, once those roots are damaged, it doesn't matter what you really do because it's done. It can't absorb. You could pour a truckload of water on that tree. If it can't get it, it can't get it because those roots are gone.
Exactly. Yeah. So those roots they're doing the same thing as that foliage is doing. That foliage is scorching and drying out. If you have roots that are in that dry environment, the fine root hairs is what I'm talking about, and those die off. And so there's actually a significant amount of root loss that's associated with drought stress, especially in those intense dry situations. And so then once rain or irrigation is added back to that soil, the tree is incapable of absorbing it anyways. So it gets Correct. Very tricky, and that's where that step three of the management approach comes in, of doing things to promote root development. And so, in soil management, that could be doing things like air work. It could be doing things like using rooting biostimulants. Could be doing things like adding a mulch ring, right? Mm-hmm. Adding compost in a mulch ring, because these parking lot island pictures that I have, it's just like bare ground. And I throw that out there. I'm like, hey, if these trees just had a good, like what arborists talk about, a 6-inch layer of wood chips over that soil, they may have done okay. Maybe, because that's going to reduce the evaporative loss of the water coming out of there. And it's going to reduce that soil temperature.
Obviously there's historical data to show that where you are regionally, it's a 90% chance you're going to hit drought. You just know it. The panhandle of Texas or Oklahoma, it's dry. Arizona, you know it's going to be dry. I think that something like that would be on a pre-scheduled appointment to get some soil remediation, because you know it's coming. Now, and I wrote down, you brought up air. You know, the air knife, fracturing soil for compaction. And I'm thinking, it just dawned on me, if you were in a hot, dry climate, would that accelerate the drying of the soil, or does it help? Or do you do like a no-till to keep that hard pan on there to keep the moisture from evaporating too quickly?
Yeah, that's a good point. And I know both of you have run the air knife. What temperature is the air coming out of the end of that device?
That's a great question. I don't think I've never tested it.
Hot and fast.
It's hot. That hot is the answer I was going for. So it's like running a hairdryer on even higher pressure. And so, yeah, that's going to dry the soil out. So whenever I was a technician doing this type of work, we always paired the air work with some sort of a liquid application as well, because there is a lot of drying that occurs in the soil when you're doing that.
I would like to add one little bit to that, because Joe, you bring up a great point. Emmett, solid on tying that together. You know, I think in my small mind, and this is just my thought process, is that small area that you're initially affecting with those air excavation tools. Yeah, dumping water on it right after, supplementing it with some deep root water, and that's going to help. But man, that's got to beat the alternative of doing absolutely nothing and letting that tree suffer through compaction and not affecting it, because like you talked about those stressors, I mean, compaction, poor soil quality, I mean, change those, the plant's health will follow. But you got to believe, I mean, you're seeing it in Texas firsthand, where, as you've already said, these trees were planted. They're probably not native, especially to those compacted or high pH soils. So I'm with you. I think that's the best, one of the best and first starts.
But yeah. Do you do it at 108 degrees?
That's the question.
Well, yeah. So that's the thing, that soil management, that's step three of my approach. And it doesn't not all three of those are happening at the same time, right? So you can fix the irrigation, you can treat for these pests and diseases. And then once you, hey, let's make sure this tree gets out of the summer alive. And then as we move into fall and winter, then we can start to address some of these soil issues and concerns.
set it up for success moving forward.
Right.
I love that. Sure. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I think that's great. Emmett, as we're looking kind of at the clock here, are there any further points that you want to get across to the listeners, or we can end if there's a piece of advice you want to give anybody out there for their careers, but any other points? I know this is something that you're knowledgeable on and you're very passionate on, that you want our listeners to hear.
Yeah, I'll share. So when I was a young technician, I was bringing in all sorts of things like, I don't know what this is, so I'm going to bring it in and ask my boss and see what he thinks. And so you learn by asking questions, and don't be afraid to ask questions. And really, what it was kind of funny, because at the time I would bring this stuff in and he would tell me, like, hey, what's wrong with this would be my question. He said, well, why don't you go into your office and look online and look in the books and see what you come up with, and then we'll talk about it. And so that's how I educated myself. From, like I said, I came out of school, I knew zero things about trees. I became a certified arborist within a year. And then in 2017, I became a board certified master arborist. And so that is a pretty quick jump from zero tree knowledge to board certified master arborist. And it's through asking questions and being inquisitive and learning one thing at a time. And that's kind of the trick to it, is you're not going to learn a career's worth of plant healthcare knowledge overnight. And so just start with what you do understand and build upon that. It's one step at a time.
I like it. That's good advice. Like I said, I think the first time I touched a chainsaw and did some tree work was 44 years ago. And I think what it finds out for me is that I never stopped asking questions. And I think I'm fortunate to have gentlemen such as you, Corey, and you, Emmett, I still bounce things off of. You know, you got to be afraid to ask the question, and you got to continue to learn, because one of our recent guests, we talk about science is changing. So there's always new ways to monitor, always new ways to address a situation in the field. And you always got great guys to ask questions for. So I think that's huge. Great, great point, Emmett.
Yeah, Emmett, on behalf of Joe, myself, all the listeners, truly thank you so much for coming on. This has been a good conversation. A lot of back and forth, a lot of in-depth on something as basic as getting water to plants. So really, really appreciated that conversation. Thank you so much. And we'll have to have you back on.
Thank you, guys. I appreciate the opportunity.
Hey, great topic today.
Yes, and lots of good information.
Yeah, probably one of our best yet.
If you enjoyed the podcast or have topics you would like to discuss, please send them to discoveringforestry@gmail.com. And please hit the subscribe button and tell a friend.
Thanks, guys, for tuning in. Until next time, I'm Joe.
And I'm Corey.
Signing out.